Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and Sunday marks a tragic anniversary. It was 30 years ago, on June 5th, 1981, that the first report of what turned out to be AIDS was published, just five cases of pneumonia in healthy young men in Los Angeles that were turned into a global pandemic infecting over 60 million people and estimated to have killed about half that number. Drugs have made AIDS into a chronic disease for many, but New York Magazine reports on renewed energy around finding a cure, a hope most researchers had abandoned. Tina Rosenberg, whose article, The Man Who Had HIV and Now Does Not, is in this week's issue, and she joins me now. And with her is Jeffrey Lawrence, director of the Laboratory for AIDS Virus Research at the Weill Cornell Medical College and a senior scientific consultant for the AIDS fighting group, AMFAR. Welcome, both of you. Thank you for coming on today.
Thanks, Brian. Nice to be here.
So, Tina Rosenberg, tell us a little bit about Timothy Brown and how he came to be cured of AIDS. It wasn't that his doctors went looking for a cure. It was almost an unintended consequence of getting leukemia, right?
Yes, he had leukemia. He was living in Berlin, and he had failed chemotherapy, and his last hope for survival was a stem cell transplant from a bone marrow donor. And his doctor, who was not an AIDS doctor, but an oncologist, a blood cancer specialist who knew very little about AIDS, did know one thing, which was that some people, a few people, about 1 in 100 people in Germany, have a certain mutation that renders them almost completely immune to HIV. They just can't catch HIV. It's a mutation that they've inherited from both parents, and it disables a receptor on immune system cells that HIV hooks onto.
Mm-hmm.
So when Dr. Gero Hütter was his name, when he went looking for an appropriate bone marrow donor for Timothy Brown, he looked for one that had this particular mutation. And he had to pay, his laboratory had to pay to test blood for this mutation because it's not normally tested. But they found one, and Timothy got his transplant. He stopped taking his antiretroviral medications right before the transplant. Unfortunately, his leukemia came back, and Hütter gave him another transplant from the same donor, which is standard practice to go back to the same donor because the patient is now accustomed to that immune system.
Mm-hmm.
He 4.5 years later now, he seems to be cured of leukemia, and the most sensitive tests to search for HIV can find absolutely no HIV in his body. So he seems to be cured of HIV as well.
Absolutely fascinating. So, Dr. Lawrence, is there anything in that story that suggests that other AIDS patients could avail themselves of this kind of cure without getting leukemia?
Absolutely, because right now this is just beyond the realm of practicality, the possibility of dying within the first 100 days after one of these transplants is better than 15%. So you'd only do them if you had another serious disease and attempt to cure, like leukemia or lymphoma. But what it teaches us is we have a proof of concept now. One person has been cured. There's no virus that we can find anywhere in this person's body, and he's been off all drugs. The technology problem now is how do you engineer cells within a person's own body or a person's own stem cells to become resistant to this virus without having to go find an unfindable donor and go through a transplant. And that's a real possibility. So that's one thing. The second thing this has done, it's re-energized the community to believe that a cure is possible. We will never treat our way out of this AIDS epidemic. I mean, a famous statistic is that for every two people that we put on therapy worldwide, 3.5 people get themselves infected. There's not enough money to treat everyone that needs to be treated. But if we can add cure to our armamentarium of the things that we can do to control and prevent AIDS, then we have a real shot at it. And that's the kinds of research we're involved in, the kinds of research that AMFAR has been funding for a long while now. And it's re-energized the National Institutes of Health, the federal government, to finally take a look at this and put some money into cure research.
Tina Rosenberg, you write in your article in New York about resistance in the scientific community to accepting that Timothy Brown was cured, and then whether it meant anything in the long run. Where does the scientific community stand now, and what was the source of that resistance?
Well, the source of it was here's this guy who no one had ever heard of, who's not even prominent in his own hospital in Berlin, who doesn't know much about AIDS at all, and he's done something that no one had ever done before. So you had a lot of people thinking, who is this guy? And then a lot of people doubted that, in fact, the HIV was really gone from his body. Now I think that is accepted. There is no doubt that Timothy Brown has at least been functionally cured of HIV. It's possible that there may be some HIV still hiding, but it's not important because he lacks these, because he has this mutation now, it can't hook on to the cells it needs to hook on to. So he's cured. That's accepted. There's a consensus about this now, and there's a lot of excitement building about cure research. The International AIDS Society has just set up an international working group on this issue. It does look like the National Institutes of Health, which had really slighted cure research. I mean, up till now, they're really spending only 3% of their AIDS research budget looking for a cure. It looks like they're going to be upping their the intensity of their cure research. So I think this case has really energized people.
Dr. Lawrence, why was AIDS thought so impossible to cure, especially after the success in developing retrovirals, which for many people at least do fairly well at managing it?
Well, for a few reasons. One, for a long time, cure was a four-letter word in many communities and many advocacy groups because of the fact that when all these potent antiretroviral drugs were developed, some people said, well, this is a cure, that all we need to do is to treat someone long enough, and they were talking about 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, suppress the virus, and basically the virus will die off and we'll have a cure. And clearly that didn't happen. But there are certain groups of people, and again, I come back to AMFAR as a foundation, where Kenneth Cole is chairman of the board, Elizabeth Taylor, Dr. Krim, Kevin Frost, and friends, were using this word with a lot of difficulty in some communities, saying that we have a real shot at it. We just have to do it in the right way. And a lot of what energized the community or energized some researchers in searching for a cure and knowing that it could be possible is just this very mutation that Tina's been talking about, that if we have a key that the virus needs to get into a cell, if we just get rid of that key, we ought to have at least a functional cure, and that's what happened. The trouble is this could never have happened in the United States.
Because of those politics?
Well, because of the politics and because of the way medicine is funded in the United States. So that in the United States, if you have an insurance policy and you need a bone marrow transplant and you go through the worldwide registry, most insurance companies will pay for the workup of two exact matches. If you have a Cadillac plan, they might pay for 10. In the Berlin case, this person had 232 exact matches, and they were going to go through all 232 until they found the one donor that had this extra little hook, this extra mutation that would potentially make him a donor to effect a cure. And it was donor number 61, actually, that they had to go through. In fact, the subtitle in the Wall Street Journal when this first came out was, "Thank you, donor number 61. In the United States, you would have gotten a donor number 2. You would have never found them.
That is fascinating. That is so fascinating, as well as disturbing. And Tina, you're right in your article about the effect that the major drug companies have on developing a cure, that it's not really profitable to cure the disease. Is that as sinister as it sounds?
It depends on your point of view. Drug companies have done a huge amount of work and put a huge amount of money into developing a treatment, because a treatment is something that you have to take every single day for the rest of your life. Hence, the drug companies will make profits every single day for the rest of your life. A cure is a one-shot. So the fact that there are some drug companies that are pursuing actively cure research, and I would mention Merck and Gilead, is pretty extraordinary.
So, Dr. Lawrence, do you think having research funded by profit-making enterprises helps or hurts in the long run?
I think it absolutely helps, because we can't all do it alone. I mean, private foundations like AMFAR need the extra support of federal organizations, the kinds of things that drug companies do well in terms of medicinal chemistry, in terms of coming up with a lead compound, searching their millions of potential drugs in their libraries of drug compounds, is incredible value to what we do. And there are some drug companies that, you know, we're focusing on kind of one way of thinking about a cure, and that is kind of replicating what happened in Berlin in a technology way that would be a one-shot deal. Another way to think about a cure that might be a lot more practical is a way to ferret out, using drugs, all those hidden latent reservoirs of virus that's silent, that's dormant, that's just kind of waiting to come out, that are unapproachable by our current drug therapy. So there are many drug companies that kind of look at this and say, gee, you know, this is a half full glass here. If we get a cure, it may be a cure where you still need to take some sort of medication to wipe out a reservoir of latent viruses for many years. And so I can applaud most drug companies in terms of the aid that we've gotten.
Before you go, scientifically, Dr. Lawrence, is it possible, does the mechanism exist yet, or is science close to it, for taking the particular DNA from this small group of people in Germany that is immune resistant and somehow doing a cut and paste into the a copy and paste into the DNA of people with AIDS without going through a whole bone marrow transplant, which, you know, besides being expensive, is just so risky. A lot of people die in bone marrow transplants.
Right. So that's the technology problem, and it's become a technology problem. There are many, many laboratories that are working on that. The issue now is when you do a transplant, you can have 100% of the cells resistant to the virus. Right now, technologically, we don't know how to take that mutation, and that mutation exists in about 1 out of 100 Caucasians in general. It's in no blacks, no African Americans, no Chinese, no American Indians, which is interesting in itself. But to engineer that into 100% of cells in a person's own body, we don't know how to do that yet. We can do it in maybe 90% of the cells in a monkey. So it's a technology problem now, and people are working on it.
Well, thank you very much, both of you, for a fascinating story. And I guess our first conversation around the 30th anniversary of the first diagnosed AIDS case is one with some hope in it, and that's a good thing. Tina Rosenberg, whose article, The Man Who Had HIV and Now Does Not, is in this week's issue of New York. And Dr. Jeffrey Lawrence is director of the Laboratory for AIDS Virus Research at Weill Cornell Medical College and a senior scientific consultant for the American Foundation for AIDS Research, AMFAR. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up next, we'll talk to the author of a book called Swimming in the Steno Pool about the history of secretarial work. And I'm sure some of you will want to call in with your great stories about being especially women in the Steno Pool. And one of the points here is how once upon a time, like when Charles Dickens wrote A Christmas Carol, the secretary was Cratchit, a guy. And then it became women's work. And then, of course, women had a hard time climbing out to anything other than secretarial work and a few other things, though that time is certainly here. So the history of secretarial work through Swimming in the Steno Pool is going to be a very interesting conversation, and we will definitely open up the phones for some of your secretarial stories on this. Stay with us.